You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 30th of June 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll find out what titles have been selling in some of our favourite independent bookshops in Buenos Aires, Paris and New York.
I've always thought of it as a New York summer novel because the descriptions of the grit and the heat in the city are so palpable. It's almost a scratch and sniff novel, frankly.
We'll also be joined by Alan Schofield from independent record store and label Honest John's, who'll be playing us a selection from their diverse array of tracks, including this one.
I'm tired of working every day. All the bill collectors after my pay.
And we'll be working through a stack of magazines with Ben Hillwood-Harris from Artwords Bookshop right here in London.
All that plus more coming up this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House, Studio One thereof, Monocle 24, Saturday midday review.
Indeed.
It is, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I'm quite excited about the chap from Honest John's coming in, because it used to be really common, the record store stroke record label, and now they barely exist anymore.
I know, and it will be interesting to see how they've managed to keep themselves afloat and keep themselves interesting as well and different. But I think when we discovered that we were having a record shop owner on today, rather than as regular listeners of the review will know... We do usually sort of stick to one genre, but we don't actually talk about the nuts and bolts of selling records, which, Andrew Muller, you did, didn't you?
I did, with the emphasis invariably is on nuts,
and there is
many of whom used to come into the shop. It's a cult, isn't it? It's an interesting sociological experiment working in a record shop. It's a fathomless peer into the abyss of human foolishness and gullibility. But I was angry, snotty teenage record shop assistant.
It did lead me to, you know, think that I was the unpleasant member of society that you've just described, you know, which other people may commonly refer to as customer. But forgive me for pushing it too much.
We never regarded them as customers. They were more these people who we just kept seeming to wandering off the street to interrupt what we were trying to listen to.
And this is a question that I will ask of the gentleman who's coming in from Honest John's. When you were a customer, or when I was a customer going into these record shops, into independent record shops, one always got the impression that, A, you were too stupid to be in the shop in the first place.
We like to communicate that idea,
and B,
yes.
It was generally about pretty girls.
Oh, absolutely. Entirely. No, whenever such creatures did come into the shop, which wasn't, frankly, that frequently, but I did notice, it was an interesting lesson in psychology, pretty girls never go to the record racks to actually look for things. They just come straight up to the counter and ask for it, in the assumption that you'll go and get it for them. And quite rightly, because we usually would, except till we figured out that if we told them we didn't have it in stock but we could order it, that they would have to come back tomorrow to check.
And then we could
usually milk each visit for a good 4 or 5 days until they figured out what we were doing.
The personal appearance of the record shop sales assistant, though? Because you'd get the pretty girls through the door and you get them to come back, yet one never got the impression that you made that much of an effort.
No, that was about as far as it went. The thought of actually, you know, washing our record company issued T-shirts or putting a comb through our hair or anything like that never really occurred to us. We just assumed that they would be fabulously impressed by our archival knowledge of Ed Cooper and The Yard Goes On Forever B-sides.
And your terrible T-shirts.
And our terrible T-shirts.
And pot bellies.
And yes, we were wrong about all of those things, as it turned out.
And stonewashed jeans and bad trainers.
It was the late 80s. That's not impossible.
Yeah.
Not
no, it's
impossible.
Not good. It's not good. Anyway, we'll be asking Alan Schofield similarly probing questions here on The Review. The time is 8 minutes past midday here in London. We'll be looking at a bookshop tour in just a moment.
No mundo todo, essa é a Monocle 24.
Haule la alam, hana Monocle, arva washri.
En todo el mundo, esta es Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong és Tokió. Ez a Monocle 24.
Από όλο τον κόσμο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Världen runt, det här är Monocle 24.
Überall auf der Welt, das ist Monocle 24.
Det coola är Monocle 24.
Around the world, this is Monocle 24.
We start today by spinning the globe and stopping off at some of the world's best independent bookshops to find out what's been flying off the shelves this week.
First up, we're in Nolita, which is apparently what we're now calling the area north of Italy.
Little Italy.
By where, I mean people other than me, obviously. But
do you mean north of Italy or north of Little
north
Italy?
North of Little Italy.
Yes.
North of Italy, that's Austria.
Or,
where they do have bookshops. However, moving seamlessly along, this report is not from an Austrian bookshop. It's Monocle's Barrett Austin, who visited McNally Jackson Books, which is an excellent store, actually, on Prince Street in New York City.
I'm Sarah McNally, owner of McNally Jackson Books. My store has always, since it opened 8 years ago, specialized in international literature. It was something that, as a non-American, when I moved to America, I felt was not being well represented in publishing or bookstores here. And so it's always been our focus, but it's a large bookstore. We do everything. We have everything from sex manuals to grammar manuals to obscure history of ancient Mesopotamia. The bookstore is in Nolita in New York, which is an abbreviation of North of Little Italy, which is mostly considered by shoppers to be part of Soho. I've got a stack of fiction in front of me. I grabbed the books that we're featuring and most excited about that are new or new in paperback, or, well, one of them is not new at all, but I think it's one of the best books I've ever read, so I've decided this summer I'm going to sell 200 copies of it. It's a personal goal. And that book is Manhattan Transfer by John Dos Passos, which was written in 1925, and it is possibly the greatest New York novel. The writing is extraordinarily rich. I've always thought of it as a New York summer novel because the descriptions of the grit and the heat in the city are so palpable. It's almost a scratch and sniff novel, frankly, but it does go through all the seasons in a time around World War I when New York still was an ocean city and the smells of the salt marshes and the smells of the river would drift over the city. And it's a magnificent book. It's a love story, but it's also a portrait of a city before and after World War I. And that is going to be our summer feature. The other book, which is just the book of the month for June, is The Great Night by Chris Adrian, which was just published in paperback, which I think was possibly the best book written last year in America. It's a fantastical story, which I think has put some people off, but like all great fantasy, it doesn't read as absurd in the least. The fantastical characters are somehow more believable than most any character in most any novel. It's rewriting of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream in a park in San Francisco. And there's a fairy war going on in the park, and three heartbroken mortals are drawn into the fairy war. And it's a symphonic, beautiful, intelligent, moving book. That's The Great Night. So those are our two big books of summer, The Great Night and Manhattan Transfer. My favorite novel in translation of this season is Satan Tango. I can't pronounce the man's name. He's a Hungarian author. It's Krasznahorkai, perhaps? Something like that. And it is a weird, wonderful book. He's long-winded and he's strange, but he's brilliant and he's colorful and he's funny. And it's blurbed by all the great lovers of international fiction, from Susan Sontag to Zabald to James Wood. It's really worth looking at if you're interested in seeing literature that's happening in other parts of the world. It's turning out here that our big book of the summer is a Crown novel by Gillian Flynn called Gone Girl. And we have done well with Gillian Flynn in the past. She's a mystery writer, and she's written Sharp Objects and Dark Places, which have done very well. And this new book, Gone Girl, it's not scary, and it's not really a mystery simply. It's ominous in a way, and it's spooky and strange, but it's also very intelligent and moving and thoughtful, and it's flying off the shelves.
And that was Sarah McNally of McNally Jackson Bookshop in New York, a lady with a delightfully whimsical voice.
She does have a nice voice. I was about to remark on that.
What were you about to remark? A delightfully whimsical voice?
I don't know if I'd have said anything as articulate as delightfully whimsical. I think I was just going to say she has a nice voice.
Very quietly passionate about her books as well. Knows every single book incredibly well, which sometimes you don't always get in a bookshop.
Indeed. Well, sometimes these days you barely even get the bookshop. But McNally Jackson is a good shop, and I'm not just saying that because, as I've just checked, they have both my titles in stock at very reasonable prices.
That was silence as my eyes rolled.
We head south next. I need all the help I can get. According to BookScan, which is a terribly addictive facility you can now log into via Amazon.com, I sold one book in the United States last week. One.
You could almost go and visit them, couldn't
you? There's 300 million of these people. One I sold last week.
That's one more.
Throw me a bone here, is what I'm saying, America. But we head south next to Buenos Aires, where our man in Buenos Aires, Ed Stocker, paid a visit to Libros del Pasaje bookshop in the Palermo district.
I'm Patricia Scott. I'm the manager here at Libros del Pasaje bookstore in Palermo, Buenos Aires. Palermo is a fashionable neighborhood in the north of the city, where you can find a lot of restaurants and bars and coffee stores. Libros del Pasaje, it's in a old house that's from the starts of the 20th century and French style. The space is dominated by wood and with high roofs and high shelves where you have to access with ladders where the public can go on, as well as the staff, to browse on these shelves. This is a general bookstore. We have all kind of themes from literature, art, philosophy, social sciences, also children's books. We try to give space to independent publishers that are growing day by day here in Argentina. We have a lot of these independent publishers here in the store. We have around 50,000 books here in the building. One of our best-selling books at the moment is Los Hijos de los Días by Eduardo Galeano. That would be like The Sons of the Day. Galeano is an author from Uruguay. He's a very political writer. This book is our small impressions of different events of contemporary affairs and political affairs from around the world, as well as Latin America. One of my personal favorites is Detectives Salvajes by Bolaño. That's an author from Chile. Beside the book area, there's a cafe and restaurant where you can have lunch. There's some menu for the day, and there's also one you can have coffees, cortados, and different kind of drinks. There's good pastry as well. We are now quite known because of our chocolate cake that's made with cookies of chocolate and lots of dulce de leche.
And that was Patricia Scott of Libros del Pasaje Bookshop in Buenos Aires. If you do have a moment, do check out their website, or in fact go there if you aren't in the vicinity, or if you're on your way to Buenos Aires, simply because Patricia in her little piece there mentioned the fact that there are ladders that the public are allowed to go up. By all accounts, those ladders look like tremendous fun, because they're not little ladders by any means, are they, Andrew?
No, they're not. I wonder if she puts all the self-help books about overcoming fear of heights on the top shelves. I would totally do that. I did once see a book on a self... I'm not making this up, and I wish I'd bought a copy of it. I was researching something. Honestly, I was, and that's why I was browsing the popular psychology shelves of Blackwell's in London, which is also a very good bookstore. And there was a book called, I'm not making this up, Overcoming Attention Deficit Disorder, 500 pages thick. I'm just saying. I really wish I'd bought a copy
of it. No, it's all right. Really? Do you think you'd have ever read it?
But would anybody have?
I don't know.
What would have been brilliant if on the last page it just said, congratulations, you're cured.
You're sorted. Well done. You're okay. No, next time, head to Libros del Pasaje for a belly full of their chocolate cake with dulce de leche, and then go for a swing on their ladders.
The cleaners would thank you for that. But finally, we're heading a bit closer to home, to Paris, where Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw visited OFR in Le Marais.
Bonjour. Donc, I'm Marie from OFR. I start OFR with my brother 16 years ago. It's a bookshop about fashion, graphism, photography, art. We are also editor and distributor. We are also publisher about Guide of Paris. It's in the Rue du Petit Thouars. It's in the third in Paris. In the middle of Paris, so it's in a in the center of the town. It's books and magazines, they come from all around the world. So we chose the magazine and the books because we love the photographer or the artist or the publisher, and it's all the time about image. We get books, magazine, and because it's about fashion, we get some accessories and some brands made in France. Meilleur Ami, it's bag and scarf, and Rivieras, shoe, it's for shoes. This week is a fashion men's week, so we get a lot of things about men and magazine like Electric House, Candy, Huge. It's a Japanese magazine, very good for men. And we get a gallery behind that we, when a book's out, like yesterday, Serge Leblon, it's a photographer, he made a book, so he came to do a book signing, and we do an exhibition. So it was a big success because he's a photographer that worked for fashion and advertising. We got books about graphic design for fashion, so it was a big success. That is a book of Matty. It was an illustrator of the album cover of Miles Davis. And we do a book signing too with that, and it was a big success. We got the book of Sol Later, it's a new one. And all the book of Helmut Newton, it's all the time a big success. We do an event all the time with an exhibition. And so it's a meeting place. People come because they get a lot of things to see, to buy, and to meet people.
And that was Marie Tumerel of OFR Bookshop in Paris. Obviously a very good place to be going this week because of Paris Fashion Week, and that's obviously why Jonathan went down there. Sounds terribly stylish. There's a lovely thing on their website where, admittedly, they are very well aware of the fact that their online sales section is key to their business, but they do give they give the usual spiel about, you know, this is, you contact us, we'll send you staff, etc., etc. And at the bottom it says in much smaller writing, oh, it's so boring to send package every day, please just come to the shop, merci.
It's a very French thing to do. There's a French satirical magazine, the title of which presently escapes me, but their website consists entirely of words saying go out and buy the magazine.
Is it the Canard? The duck.
I think it might be, yes.
The Weekly Duck, yes.
Exactly,
I know.
It doesn't.
The chained up duck. They don't brook the internet.
No.
It took them a long time
no.
to get the internet.
But you can tell that, you know, it was the French that invented the word insouciance. Stay with us on the review. Coming up after the break, we will be reviewing this week's music selection, which comes to you from Honest John's record store and includes a sublime acoustic number from Bogota, among much else. And we'll also be flicking through a stack of this week's selection of magazines. You're listening to Monocle 24.
It's that time of year again when City Hall officials dab their concerned brows and mayors worry if they've raised their game enough to even get a mention. That's because Monocle's bumper annual quality of life survey is hitting newsstands with its ranking of the top 25 cities to call home. Pick up your copy to see whether your town is a magnetic metropolis or a city on the slide. The July-August double issue comes with many more surprises too, from 5 cities that are never going to win on metrics but which we love anyway, to 10 surprising leaders you should know, to 50 things to improve your life. And our editors have been busy rounding up many more reports.
This month we sit down with the Mayor of New York, Mike Bloomberg. We showcase some of the best concierges from New York to London, and we visit a suburb with style, Wannsee, in Berlin.
In the business section this month, we look at the business of logistics, meeting the delivery people, couriers and security services that make moving things around dense urban environments possible and even pleasurable. We'll also be getting on our bikes when we take management tips from the woman who spearheaded the two-wheeled revolution in Montreal.
You'll find all this and more in the July-August issue of Monocle that's on newsstands now.
Premiering on Monocle.com, a film about the city we feel ranks number one for quality of life. Monocle's annual survey goes beyond the basic economic and social aspects of a city, identifying often overlooked factors that can bring happiness and ease to everyday life. And for the second time running, climbing back up to the number one spot, it's Zurich.
On a sunny early summer's day in Zurich, a handful of its residents have made their way to Badi Enge, one of several bathing houses situated along the waterfront, offering decks for sunbathing, bars, and even saunas. The scene is especially notable for taking place minutes from downtown, and it's what sets Zurich immediately apart. This is a city with abundant and interconnected green space, cut through by rivers leading to its lake, all of it set up to be enjoyed by the population.
You can watch this film, plus our top 25 most livable city countdown, on monocle.com.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson, and Andrew Muller.
Indeed, and it's time now for our weekly music review, and today we're joined by Alan Schofield of Honest John's, a almost legendary, in fact definitely legendary, independent record store and label based in London's Notting Hill. Honest John's is renowned for, among much else, its compilations of recordings from often generally disregarded times and places. It's exactly the shop to go to if you want to hear music from 1950s Beirut, Afro-Cuban jazz from the Bronx, German electro-funk from the 1970s, or Sri Lankan synth-pop. Good morning. Afternoon, Alan.
Hi, hey.
Morning, afternoon. We're on the crux. It's a bit after midday.
Feels like morning.
I don't know if you heard our discussion earlier. I used to work in a record shop many, many years ago, which was in every respect.
Where was that?
It was in Sydney. It was a very suburban record shop in Crow's Nest in the northern suburbs of Sydney. But we did used to do the thing of being insufferably rude to customers, except the three who listened to the same records we did. Do you maintain a similar policy at Honest John's or not?
John told me when he gave me a job in 1987 not to be like that. And it's very difficult to be cheerful and up all the time. So there are times when you get into terribly grumpy wrangles with people that you really didn't want to have, you know, situations develop. Why don't you have the record? I don't know why I don't have the record. You know, you say really rude things. It's just, I don't know why. But as I say, John's line, first thing he said was, you know, don't be the cliche. Welcome people. And it's quite a nice thing to try to defy that. But I do have a good rudeness anecdote, which predates my time at Honest John's. For an example, there's a guy called Ray who's still around in Portobello selling records. He used to work in the shop, and somebody came in once and I just had bought a single, and he said, came back the next day, said the single's scratched. And Ray said, you know, he said, I want to return the single. He said, why? It's scratched. So Ray just took the single, picked up a Stanley knife, scratched it, and handed it back to him and said, it is now. So that John's first lesson didn't sink in with that.
Who was John?
John is John Clare, a sociology student from Liverpool who in 1974 got a lease in a store in Goulburn Road and was a music buff and phoned his mate in Liverpool and said, come down, let's have a go. And he sold... Mark and I, we own the shop now. We worked for John for many years. And then 20 years ago, he sold it to us and went on to become a painter and has a B&B in Hay, which is very good, and is also a psychotherapist, which, you know, his line was that the best training for psychotherapy is running a record shop for 15 years.
Yeah,
in Portobello Road.
That's exactly what we were saying today, because I was one of the customers, not necessarily in Sydney, but I think this rudeness affliction was a problem common to every independent record shop in the 1980s and 90s, where you A, never found a woman behind the counter, B, it was surly men in slightly grubby T-shirts.
That was you, wasn't it?
I've got the T-shirt.
You did walk in and I did think, oh my goodness, he's got the T-shirt, but I suspect it's clean.
It's clean.
You see, things change. And how welcome we are. So you have Honest John's, and obviously you adopt the politeness ethic, which clearly has worked. When did Honest John's decide to become a label and then such a successful one as a result? How did it get there?
Well, it was giving birth to labels from the word go and lots of people who worked in the shop. Well, you know, the grubby guy in the T-shirt, the rude man, often went off to become a record label owner or, you know. For instance, Nick Gold, who started a World Circuit, used to work for John. World Circuit was the label that put out the Buena Vista Social Club. And Nick used to bore John endlessly about this project he had in mind of recording African musicians in Cuba, which transmogrified into, you know, the sort of 10 million selling Buena Vista Social Club, and he used to say to John, can you come in with me 50-50 on this? I've got a really good idea. And John would say, no, would you please sweep up and be nice to customers? And, well, Nick went off and made a huge amount of money and has got this wonderful label called World Circuit. So lots of people that work for in the shop, like when we took over, we had a kid called James Lavelle. He went on to start a label called Mo Wax in the basement.
The
and so it was giving birth to labels the whole time. But about 2000, we had a good friend, a guy who became a good friend of ours, a customer called Damon Albarn, who on the side, a very successful musician in a band called Blur, was a regular. We were sort of equidistant from his studio in his house, so he would sort of pop in on the way to work. And became a good friend, a good customer, like an ideal customer, because he just loves music.
What is an ideal customer? Someone who understands music?
Somebody who buys a lot.
Right. Well, obviously, yeah.
No, but on a more
Damon has the advantage of being able to afford to
this
buy
is true.
A lot, of course,
so
well.
There's that aspect. But there's what I mean is he would listen to reggae B-sides and he would listen to 1920s blues and he would get excited by something like Malian music, which is kind of where he got into West African music. We were his library in a way. And so we sort of formed a sort of quite interesting friendship where the three of us were, you know, feeding each other and inspiring each other with records.
But what you're describing here, I mean, it's great, but it's an incredibly old model. This is the way the world used to be, where people used to have a relationship with their record shop and you'd go in every week and say what's interesting and what's new and you'd get to know record shop assistants and, you know, and people would exchange ideas and talk about music do other things. And it's almost all gone now. But so how have you survived? How is Honest John still able to do that? Is it just because nobody else is and this is the last place you can go?
Not entirely, but there was a horrible cull. But just to finish that story, it was Damon said one day to me, just casually, we should start a label. And I've got a record that he'd been in Mali and he'd recorded a bunch of music in the street and in people's houses, and that became our first release. So one answer to your question, how do we survive, is we started a label. We branched out. We figured something out. We couldn't just stand there and wait for people to come in and ask for a record, because that stopped happening in a big way in the late 90s, early 2000s. Because of downloads, because of Amazon, because of all those what seemed as evil, horrible things. There's a horrible cull of record stores, something like 2,000 record stores 15 years ago, and there's about 200 now in the UK. So my theory is that if you did survive this horrible cull, you know, you were strong, you had something going, you were strong enough, and you were one of the last few, and then funny thing happened 2 or 3 years ago, is suddenly record stores became hip again. Records became hit. You know, people were coming in and the shop started to buzz again. So,
well, you brought some music in that you want to hear us. One of the songs, you just mentioned Damon Albarn there, and one of the songs you brought us is a song which is from one of Damon Albarn's latest of his many and diverse projects, Rocket Juice and the Moon. Tell us a little bit more about it.
This is a project that he said a couple of years ago, I've got a great idea for the label. I've got a record that's got to come out on Honest John's. It's the best place for it. And he'd been jamming with two friends, Tony Allen, the legendary Nigerian Afrobeat drummer, and Flea, from the bass player from Red Hot Chili Peppers. They'd met at some sort of festival or something. And Tony's been working with Damon for a long time, and we've put up records by Tony over the last few years. So he's a good mate. And the record started as jam sessions in their free time. And then it sort of boiled down to grooves, and then we passed the grooves around to different vocalists, and we made this record called Rocket Juice and the Moon.
That was Rocket Juice and the Moon with Follow Fashion, a album released by Honest John's earlier this year, a sort of supergroup, Rocket Juice and the Moon, comprising Blur's Damon Albarn, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Flea, the Nigerian drummer Tony Allen, and others. They did have it's a very sort of organic record, that wasn't it, to the extent that the musicians basically even let somebody else pick a name for the band.
Oh, yeah, Damon said, oh, you figured it out. So it was quite a funny story. We have a friend in Nigeria who's done lots of covers for us, an artist called Adamola, and we asked him to do the cover for the record. It seemed appropriate. It had a sort of Nigerian kind of root. He wanted to know what it was called, and we weren't quite sure. And he sent us, he listened to the record, and he heard there's a song with a Rocket Juice on it, and there's a song about the moon. And he wrote Rocket Juice and the moon as a part of a collage. And he said, here's some ideas. And Damon went, oh, great, there's the name.
Damon Albarn is renowned for having this sort of ragtag, haphazard, almost haphazard approach to gathering brilliant musicians and then creating a brand new project and then moving on to something else. Obviously, Honest John's had a very instrumental role in creating the last project. Mm. How much of a role does Honest John's have with the artists?
Sometimes surprisingly little, in the sense that, you know, somebody can send us a record, you know, make a record. We don't sit in the studio and twiddle with knobs. We let people we trust people to produce the music that they have in them. But, you know, one of the main sort of parts of our catalogue is old compilations of old existing music. But we do often put out new records, and we usually just, you know, the band will record them. Sometimes we have a bit more active approach. The Rocket Juice was such a complicated thing because Damon just gave us the grooves, basically. So with that last song, the vocalist is a wonderful woman called Fatoumata Diawara, Fatou, who's on Nick Gold's World Circuit label. She has a great record on that label. I recommend it. And so we sent her the groove, and she recorded the vocal in Paris. And then there's a Ghanaian rapper later in the track who chipped in at a different. So it was a complicated record, finally mixed by our great friend Mark Ernestis in Berlin, who just makes a beautiful sound.
You talk about those compilations you release. Mm. I mean, to what extent do you ever have any idea what's going to sell or what's going to take root and what isn't, or do you just put things out there more or less as they take your fancy?
This is an element of, you know, following your passions and trusting your instincts. But of course, we're a business, and you know, had a shop for 20 years and running a small label. You've got to pay for the pressings. You've got to pay the artists. You've got to, you know, there's a lot of bills. So you can't, you know, you can't just be completely ignore the economy of it all. So but I think the interesting thing is these days, there's a lot of small labels around. It's a flourishing time for the music industry in a funny way. The big companies have all gone completely, you know, to bits. I mean, they're floundering, in my opinion, and on the verge of bankruptcy. But in the cracks of the pavement, there's these wonderful sort of flowerings of small labels all over the world, Australia, Japan, the States. And being in a small record shop, we're part of that family. And so we're getting records that maybe somebody makes 300 copies of. We get 50 of them. That's the kind of dynamism of our scene.
Let's move on to another track that you've brought in by a group from Bogota. Absolute mishmash of all kinds of genres here. Mm. This is Las Malas Amistades and Maleza. That was Apocalyptica by Las Malas Amistades. We're joined by Alan Schofield from Honest John's record store and label based in London's Notting Hill. Alan, there's a strange sort of amateurish and quite I recorded that in my back kitchen feeling
totally.
To it.
Yeah, they're kind of anarcho, sort of folky art students going back whose first records, they didn't know how to play anything. I mean, they
actually made that a selling point, didn't they?
Yeah.
That we are just making this up as we go, including learning these instruments.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to run the recording, the tape recorder, before we've learned how to play anything. This record, as you can tell, they've been around for 15 years and they can play a bit. And it's got that lovely sort of saudade, you know, that word, that Portuguese sort of nostalgia, pain, sorrow feel to it. I think that's a lovely song.
In the little bit of the press stuff that's associated with this group, there's a highlight of the difference in listening experience that you get between when you understand what the lyrics are about and when you don't.
Mm.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
I can just say that the lyrics, that song's called apocalyptic song, Apocalyptica, and it's about sort of the world turned upside down, the poles are being in the wrong place, and the floods flooding, and the deserts dry, you know, everything turning upside down. So that's what the song's
and
about.
And yet it has a delightful, sunny, breezy, sunny afternoon.
There's a lilt, yeah, exactly. Well, I guess there's a cleverness in their music and in their songs, yeah.
Let's move on to the third and final tune that you've brought in. Some good old-fashioned generic funk.
Yeah.
Who is this?
Arnie Love and the Lovettes. This is 1982, New York, sort of boogie disco. A small label called Jazzman, one of the little labels that's around in London. A friend of ours, Gerald, put this out on a 7-inch. It's from, New York. Arnie Love was called the Gospel Teddy Bear.
Arnie Love and the Lovettes, We Had Enough.
A record. The best names of a singer I've heard for a very long time.
A record that could really only have been made in 1982. The third and final of our selection today from our musical guest, Alan Schofield of Honest John's. Alan, we were attempting to research Arnie Love earlier. It's not easy. He's a bit of a mystery man.
I don't think there's much in the catalogue. The label is called Tap Records, which is also a complete unknown, it's a loss in the mists of time, but it's very interesting. There's a great label around today called Numero Records from Chicago, and they put together these fantastic compilations of obscure labels, and one of them box sets they've done is the Tap Records story, and I do recommend it. It's got some great stuff on
it. Who is the market now for stuff like that? Where's it being played?
Well, there's Soul Boys who've been into that all the time, and funk is, you know, there's always an appetite for funk. You know, you dance to it. So there's DJs but there's a whole new generation growing up who didn't know anything. You know, I'm old enough to have been in New York in 1982, as it happens when that record just came out. But you know, like my son, who's 22 or whatever, he loves boogie. He's a DJ, and that's his lifeblood. So I don't know. You know, there's a whole generation that's finding that music. So it's just an underground, but vital scene, you know.
Are there any genres of music which you really wish there was a wider audience for, but just doesn't ever seem quite to, you know, it's waiting for Damon Albarn to walk in and go, I found this record, and then it'll be all right.
Not polka, but there must be something, yeah. I think one of the interesting things about today with this flowering that I'm trying to describe is that so many obscure genres, periods of musical history, styles, etc., are being beautifully repackaged and put out. So it's a good time to be a music fan.
You came into the Monaco Country Fair a couple of weeks ago,
yeah,
and you had your stall, your Honest John stall.
Yeah, there I was.
How did that go?
Really well. It was a really, really great event, and people were, boxes of records on a table turned people on. It's quite, people would come over and go, oh, records. Which is
like we haven't seen them for
a long time. Wow, records. Look, there's a record. I can see, it's like, oh, that's
But
nice.
Does that still appeal mostly to people who are old enough to remember buying records, or is there a kind of cachet attached to them by people who are just discovering vinyl?
I think there's something about these days. People are constantly saying, oh, records are coming back. And well, for us, they never went away. But yeah, there's a whole new generation, bunch of people who are getting into the beauty of vinyl.
It's an absolutely delightful way to end that lovely interview. Thank you so much indeed, Alan Schofield from Honest John's, an independent record store and label based in London's Notting Hill. A very, very discreet way of saying that it's clearly a musical powerhouse that you're operating off Portobello Road there. Very warm. And thank you very much indeed, Alan, for coming in. You're listening to The Review. We'll be back in a moment with a stack of magazines to review.
It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson. We've now reached that point in the programme where we get someone to bring in a great big pile of magazines that they like and leaf through them. And the person with the stack this week is Ben Hillwood-Harris from Artwood's Bookshop.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hi.
Tell us about Artwood's Bookshop.
We are a bookshop based in the East London, just north of the city in Shoreditch, trendy Shoreditch. We also have another shop on Broadway Market, which is Londonfield, Central Hackney. We are a visual arts bookshop. We cover all areas of the visual arts, including fashion, photography, art, architecture, graphic design.
How did you come about?
Well, I'd been to art school. After art school, I was working in a bookshop, and the two sort of converged, really. Shortly after that, I worked for the Serpentine Gallery, running their bookshop with a good friend of mine, job shared for 10 years or so. And then we went our separate ways, and I started up my own shop, really.
It's an ambitious thing when bookshops are so frequently in the headlines for being under threat. The fact that it is a specialist bookshop, did that sort of save you slightly?
Well, I mean, I guess when I started up, Amazon was a very young venture, so nobody really knew what the how the future would unfurl. And nowadays, I think it's a concern for anybody selling books. You know, what the how the future will pan out. You know, at the moment, I can safely say I think that for a lot of people, visual arts books need to be looked at prior to buying. So stores like Amazon, things like that, don't really aren't able to cater for that market.
Especially in your area of bookselling, do you think that Amazon has actually really ruined that a little bit? Not Amazon per se, but the fact that everybody now may well go to Amazon as a very popular destination. The fact that your books especially need to be looked at and touched and held and, you know, have that physicality that we all talk about all the time. Has that damaged your trade in any way?
Yeah, and undoubtedly, yes. I mean, you know, in hard economic times as well, I mean, you know, unfortunately, understandably, you know, even if somebody comes in to look at a book in a bookshop, they may still go away and buy it elsewhere where they can get it at a better price.
But do you have the advantage in dealing with visual arts, though, that most of this stuff, at least so far, still just does plain look better on a page than it does on a computer screen, and that is obviously going to be important to the kind of people who would buy these publications?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of crux of the matter, I suppose. And, you know, we haven't discussed digital publishing, but you know, I suppose in my own mind, I would imagine that my clients, the people, my customers, are quite often working professionally in the arts somehow, commercial arts or otherwise, you know, ultimately they're still producing objects, and that's what I'm dealing in, ultimately objects.
As an independent bookseller, what determines what you put in your shop, because you have free choice?
You know, I suppose for me, I've given myself the remit of hopefully bringing the most interesting sort of visual trends and ideas within a retail space, if that makes sense. So, you know, it's idiosyncratic to a certain extent. It's not completely true, but you know, I do disregard some things that I don't think are interesting, and try and bring in things that I think are, well, you know, I'd like to think groundbreaking, but I'm sure not necessarily groundbreaking, but nonetheless sort of pushing and breaking the mould a bit.
And how compelled do you feel to follow trend?
That's an interesting question. You know, I think it's a give and take situation, really. You know, I think trend is interesting because it when it goes out of fashion, it's when we've all become accustomed to it. So trend is still something that is leading us and is engaging us.
You have brought in a stack of books, which Andrew has been thoroughly thumbing in the last couple of minutes. Normally, we are quite well versed in the magazines that are brought
right.
in. Today, Ben, you have absolutely thrown us.
Well, I apologise if I have.
We haven't a clue what you've brought in. Because
okay.
these are explained only available in your bookshop.
No, that's not true. There's only one there that is, and I only found that out yesterday, which, if you want to start on it, which is it's the first issue of a new French magazine called The Shelf.
I wanted to go to that one because it's one of those, it feels nice.
It
immediately
feel nice.
You want to pick it up. And it looks beautiful as well.
Describe
it to us.
Well, The Shelf is the first issue of a new magazine. And I guess what the publishers are doing here is trying to explore the power and beauty and the physicality of publications and books. And, you know, I suppose it's a good starting point for me because that's ultimately where I'm at. So that's what I'm trying to sell to my customers.
But how big an audience of that community does a magazine like that need to reach to actually pay for itself? Because there isn't any advertising in it, so far as I can tell. And as everybody knows, this is a rough time for independent magazines. And this week in Britain in particular, we've seen the Word magazine finally have to give up and pull its plugs, which is dreadfully sad. So, but with a very specialist niche publication like this, how many people do you think they're able to reach or need to reach?
Well, that's good. You know, like a lot of these magazines, they're done for the love of the production as much as anything. So they would be hoping to reach, you know, a wider an audience as possible. But I would imagine that their print run is probably under 1,000 copies. But, you know, I'd hope, I would imagine that they would be hoping to reach people with pretty sophisticated tastes.
How, I mean, being absolutely brutal here and being recognizing what the market is like, how long do magazines like Shelf, not wishing to kill it off immediately, how long do they last?
Well,
you must see them come and go.
It's an amazing time for publishing at the moment, which, you know, seems completely counterintuitive. I see perhaps five new magazines a week at the moment coming out.
Where are they coming out from?
Well, they're coming out from all over the world, and we're getting them from the Far East, we're getting them from the US, getting them from Europe. But I mean, how many go beyond two or three issues is difficult to know, but it's the seriality that, you know, the serial nature of magazines, I think, is changing as well. So many of the more important magazines that I stock and deal with are now turning into sort of biennial publications. So they're not dependent on, you know, day to day information. They are out there sort of promoting their own. They've got an agenda of their own that they're putting out.
Well, tell us a bit about this one magazine I'm holding here. Appears to be an exception to some of those rules because it says issue 12 on the cover. And this is
congratulations.
This is Pinup, which does retail at a fairly hefty US $15. Where does Pinup come from, and how have they stayed afloat this long?
I don't know the editors of any of these magazines. Actually, that's a lie. I do know Modern Matter, it's let's say there's two a year for this magazine. I think it's published in the US, but this is an issue all based around Berlin. I'm sorry, I can't answer the question about the economics of these things. I mean, I've had a magazine in just a couple of days ago, which I imagine was a marketing tool. The one advert in it paid for the whole magazine, and it was a marketing tool.
That's very clever.
But whether it's interesting or not, I don't know.
The one magazine I'm absolutely fascinated by is Cabinet, because... it's a rarity. I mean, forgive me if I've been missing hundreds of others, but magazines that do antique objects well are few and far between. And this seems to do it rather well. What do you think of Cabinet, and why have you brought it in?
Cabinet is it's a very well established within the contemporary visual arts world. Every issue has a theme, and I think this one is games. Comes out four times a year. And it's just a fantastic collection of a diverse range of voices on a particular theme. And I just think it's something that you wouldn't find online. You wouldn't find in that way. It's very well researched. It's very well written. And it's just idiosyncratic in its kind of collection of information. We sell a lot of it. It's as popular for us as a well-known magazine. You know something like Freeze magazine or something like that.
But I think that is still the strength that magazines do have over the internet. It's not. It's the fact that people, I think, still want to read longer pieces on paper rather than on screen. And plus, it is also the result of a kind of collaborative process between editor and writer rather than just somebody splurging their brains all over a keyboard.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just so much more. It's so much more clearly thought out. You know, self-publishing. So there's an authority to the magazine. There's an authority to the physical object, and I think that's where I'm at with the bookshop.
Ben Hillwood-Harrods, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for coming in. That was Ben Hillwood-Harrods from Artwood's Bookshop in London. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
And that brings us to the end of this Saturday's review. It's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show today was produced by Alexander Mills, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Sam Impey.
We're handing back over to Georgina Godwin next with the weekend edition, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. Don't forget as well to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller.
And me, Ennen Emma Nelson.
And her, Emma Nelson. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.